Sabbath in San Diego. But I understand there was a lot of wind and rain too. That's what makes it so beautiful. Clears the air. Of course, you don't have that problem. We do far away, but it is beautiful. And welcome to Point Loma. And maybe take a moment, just smile or wave or hug or shake hands with somebody around you. We're kind of spread out this morning. That's okay. Go ahead and do that. I'm not here.
There's no rush here. Except unless you want to rush to the front. I'm going to have to stand maybe halfway back.
Then what about us?
That we'll have to turn around. That's great. Got a lot of people enjoying family time this week, I'm sure. We'll see them, their faces again next week. You know, I've had this experience a number of times in my life. I haven't stopped to count them, but being a sanguine, often you find yourself in a situation where you're elaborating on something and you're really into what you're saying. You're all excited and all pumped up, and you look over and the person is sound asleep. Now, some of you have never had that experience. But when we used to go on long trips with our family, my wife would say to me, after about maybe 2 or 3 hours into the journey, we would drive from Oregon down to Northern California, and she would say, "Your boys have already played all their Game Boys, and they've sang a bunch of songs, and they've fought over the toys in the back seat, and things are getting kind of rugged." And she'd go, "Why don't you tell the boys a story of your childhood, you know?" And so I would launch into one of my stories of growing up in the jungles of Borneo. And you know, when you have kids, you kind of, the stories get better every year, you know. And my grandson, man, some of the stories he hears, my son, we're sitting there listening to the story, and they'll say, "Dad, you never told us that." I go, "I just remembered it." Not really. But you know, storytellers like to, you know, they add all lots of detail, you know, that sometimes, you know, as we used to say, grandpa's stories, his snake stories, the snakes get bigger and bigger, longer and longer. And I find that's true with my story now. My wife keeps me on track though, but what would happen is I'd be telling these stories, you know, and I'd be going along, and I'm bored too, you know, because all I'm watching is the line in the middle of the road, you know, and I'm bored to death. So I'm telling the story, and I'm thinking of all the ways that I can make the story longer and more exciting and all that. And then I notice it's pretty quiet. I look in the mirror and hear the voice. And I look over at my wife. So I'm talking to myself the last 20 miles, you know. I mean, what's that about? You asked me to tell the story, you're not even listening. And then, of course, I remember that they've heard the story probably 100 times. But you know, isn't that kind of the way it is sometimes? You know, you ever been in a situation where you're talking away at this person and they're over there on the cell phone? Would you say? What? You know? I wonder if maybe that's kind of a little bit of what God experienced with the children of Israel. Don't you think so? I mean, here they are in this journey from Egypt to the Promised Land. And God is trying His very best to talk to them. And, you know, thank goodness, God is patient and long-suffering. And he doesn't have just, you know, one bullet in His gun. I mean, He's got many ways of getting people's attention. And you look at this story and you think, okay, so let's back up. We're in Egypt now. And these people, the children of Israel, have seen all the amazing things that happened, you know, the plagues and all this, and the amazing miracles that God performed to set them free, to twist the arm of Egyptians to let them go. They've seen it all. They've experienced some of it. And they've seen even God blessing them with the wealth of Egypt, you know? I mean, it says that the people actually came out and gave their gold and silver to the children of Israel and said, please take us and leave. You know? Have you ever had that when you moved from a community? No, probably not. It'd be kind of nice, wouldn't it? A little down payment for the house you're going to buy. But that's what they were given, the wealth of Egypt. Please leave. Take it and leave. We can't take any more of this, you know? And then, of course, they saw God's mighty hand. They're protecting them as they cross the Red Sea, parting of the Red Sea. That, you know, I don't know about you, but that in itself would be enough for me, don't you think so? How would you like it if one day God said, hey, let's go over to Catalina Island, and you said, okay, well, let's get in the boat. God says, no, don't worry about that. And he opens up the ocean over to Catalina Island, and you walk through. You're laughing. You say, well, no, don't be silly. That's exactly what happened to the children of Israel. Not only that, God is watching over them in the pillar of fire by night. So they had a built-in heating system for the cold desert at night, and lighting to go with it. And then in the daytime, he protects them from the heat of the desert, the heat of the sun, with a cloud. And the cloud kind of moves, well, it leads them through the desert. And as long as the cloud is there, they stay under the cloud, they're not going to get sunburned. And at night, they're going to stay warm. And in spite of all that, now as far as I'm concerned, that's God talking to me. When God starts parting oceans for me and sea, you know, the Red Sea for me, and when he starts providing shade in the hot Palm Springs sun, and when he keeps me warm when I'm up on the hills, you know, snow skiing or whatever, that would, don't you think that would be God speaking to you? Put yourself in their place. I may have mentioned this once before, but I'll go through it again. I wrote it in my Bible. Because it absolutely blew my mind. A number of years ago, a gentleman who worked for the armed forces, a Christian man, when he retired, he sat down and figured out how much it would cost or what it would take to take, you know, 3.5 million people from Egypt to the Promised Land. And he was an officer in the military who actually did this for a living. He would get all the food and the water and put all whatever it would take to support an invasion force, okay, like Desert Storm or Afghanistan. And shiploads of food and water. And he sat down and calculated it out because he'd done it all of his life. He knew exactly what it was going to cost. Listen to this. This is a blowing mind. The figures just are unbelievable. It would take 1,500 tons, not pounds, tons of food per day. Food per day. That's not sea rations, because they didn't have them back then. This is food for these people. Which would be the equivalent of two freight trains. Okay, two freight trains filled with food that are a mile long. Okay, get that? 40,000 tons of firewood. 40,000 tons of firewood. Nine or whatever sort of trees in the Middle East. 40,000 tons of wood. And of course, what they're whining and complaining about here to Moses is, you know that when you go in the desert, you're foolish if you don't take water with you, right? I mean, a lot of water, not just, you know, I try to drink at least one or two of these a day, right? But if I were to go out to Palm Springs or out to the Brega Desert or you know, wherever, I would need to take more than that. And you don't even realize that you're sweating sometimes. It's so hot that it just dries you right on your skin. You don't even know how much water you've swallowed out. So you've got to take a lot of water. Listen to this. How much water would it take? Here's a good trivia question. How much water would it take to provide for 3.5 million people per day? Anybody got a figure? 11 million gallons of water. 11 million gallons of water. That's a day. That I don't think even includes those that need to take a bath or should take a bath. Okay? That's just drinking water. The equivalent would be a tanker. You know, you've seen them on the trains pulling these big tankers. Oh, and you see them on the freeway too, you know, the water tankers. They go up to Lake Arrowhead or up to Lake Arrowhead or wherever they get the water and they bring it down here. They put it in bottles and they sell it to you for $5 or $4 or $3. And say it's spring water from Lake Arrowhead, and it really is. But anyway, we still, you know, we like to trick ourselves, fool ourselves. It would take a tanker, that's a train. Now listen to this. This one would have blew my mind. 1,800 miles long. Now, if somebody wanted to figure out how far that away, the nearest destination from here, if it's 1,800 miles, how far would that be?
El Paso.
See, there's a man who's got his calculator. El Paso. He's an engineer, though. He knows. El Paso. That's a train all the way from the Dead Sea to Egypt and back again, probably several times. Okay. It goes on. Yeah. It gets into real trivia. But you understand. You get the picture now? These people are wandering around. Oh, one more thing I thought was interesting too. He added to the calculations that to cross the Red Sea, just the crossing of the Red Sea, all right? Figuring on 3.5 million. It would take 5,000 people shoulder to shoulder. Okay, 5 people shoulder to shoulder. The width, crossing the Dead Sea. It would take them 3 days. And that really puts into perspective how many people and all it would take to provide for them. Now remember, God told the children of Israel, I am. I am. I am your provider, Yahweh. I will provide everything you need. All your needs will be provided. Just remember, just trust me. Just have faith in me. And they had seen God's hand in a mighty way, protecting them from the enemy, providing for them. But it seems that God, at some point here, needed to get their attention again. So maybe they went a few hours without a drink of water or something. I'm not sure exactly what sparked this uprising. But they start whining. They start fussing. God is talking to them. He's talking and he's talking and he's talking to them. He's promising them. He's blessing them. He's telling them what he's going to do for them and what he's already done for them. And he's talking and talking and they're all in the back seat sleeping. By the way, just so that you don't get the wrong idea, when my wife falls asleep in the car, that's just a given. When I first started dating her, first time we went for a drive about to Bodega Bay, those of you that know that area, Northern California, it's a beautiful drive. Oh, it's beautiful all along the way. The ocean is absolutely gorgeous. I love that stretch of the highway that goes all the way to the coast of Oregon. She fell asleep. And how do you fall asleep in an Austin Healey Sprite that sounds like a hornet that's mad? Because I had my exhaust coming out the side, you know, with a blast pack on it. It was noisy. In fact, people years later have said, oh, yeah, you're the guy with the awesome view that was really loud. Yeah, that was me. She went to sleep. And I just kind of ignored it, thought, that's what she's tired. Then I found out when I brought it to her attention a number of months later, because it became a regular thing. Already that morning. That her mother, when she was a baby, to get her to go to sleep at night, would take her apart right around the clock. So it preconditioned her to fall asleep. Anyway, so now you know why my wife falls asleep in the car. That's a good idea, by the way. Yeah, those of you that have kids or have kids, it works. It really does. I've tried it a couple of times. But I'm preconditioned to fall asleep when I hear a fan blowing. So to this day, I have a fan right next to my head, blowing on me. And that's because I grew up in the tropics where you had to have a fan going. And it wasn't until I came to America and couldn't sleep at night. I thought, what's the problem? Why can't I go to sleep? And then I tried turning the fan on, went straight to sleep. My wife, she made fun of me when we first got married. Why do you have to have that stupid fan blowing in your face? Try taking her fan away from her now. I have a condition.
That's great. That's great.
That's why I don't have to take her apart on the block every night. Anyway, so God is trying to talk to the children of Israel. He is trying to get their attention, and it seems that everything that he has done would have gotten their attention. They would have gotten the point across. They would have gotten the idea. But it seems that they still don't trust God. As much talking as he has done, as much blessing as he has done, as much incredible, awesome miracles that he has performed, way beyond your imagination, they still don't trust him. And so, as the story tells us, that God tells Moses, well, Moses, the conversation I really enjoy, the conversations that Moses has with God throughout the stories of the Exodus and beyond even. He says, go out in front of the people and take with you some of the elders and take in your hand that staff. Now remember the staff. This is the staff that was used to perform the miracles in front of the Pharaoh. And this was the staff that Moses had used to herd sheep. So it was something that he kept close to him. He said, I want you to take that out with you. And I will stand before the people at the rock of Horeb and strike the rock. And water will come out of it for the people to drink. Now, I had never noticed this before, but you need to read that really carefully, because sometimes we can read through something and go, yeah, I know that story. I've known it since I was a little kid. Look at what it says here. It says, I will stand there before you, by the way. Who will stand there? Moses? God. Oh, so there's a visual. Once again, there's a visual. Not only do they have the visual aspect of this relationship that God's trying to build with them, they have the audible, which sometimes was even deafening. In fact, we know as we get later on in the story, we'll get to this, but when they're around Mount Sinai, the audible is so bad that they plug the roof and they run in terror. But there's a visual, a constant reminder that God is present. God is here. I am here. I am the I am. I am Yahweh. I am your provider. Now, Moses, on the other hand, Moses had kind of had a running start with his relationship with God. So we can give him, we can give him a little bit, he should be a little tougher than the children of Israel, right? Because he got a running start there at the burning bush. Children of Israel, they're just little babes in the Lord, they're still whining and doubting his presence and all those things. So let's just give Moses, let's give the children of Israel, rather, a chance. They're still trying to to grow in their faith. You know, that's true.
That's true.
You know, let's bring that concept home. There are some of us who have been on the way a long time. We've had more time to develop that relationship with God, that trust, that faith in God. So as Paul says, take it easy on the young Christians, all right? Take it easy on the baby Christians. Give them a break. Give them a chance. And so we have here an example that God deals with each individual personally. A lot of times we as Christians and church members, we work too hard sometimes on the baby Christians. We're a little rougher on them. We want them to catch up. Bring them up to speed. Come on, you've got to know everything that I know and experience everything I've experienced, and your faith needs to be strong within 6 days. All right? Or 7 years. Or 7 months. Not so. God will work with each of us individually. Because our eternal salvation is based on that personal relationship. There is a corporate expression, yes. There's a corporate experience, but there's also an individual experience. We need to remember that. And when it comes to a church family, each of us has a personal walk with God. And that's very vital. It's very important. We're not going to be saved as a church. We're going to be saved as individuals. Hopefully the whole church, but that's between you and God, right? So the personal experience is vital. And we look at this story and we say, wow. So Moses did that. He stood there and God stood there and he struck the rock. The water came out. It's interesting here at the end of this reading, this passage that we are looking at. And he named the place Massah of Meribah because Israelites quarreled and because they tested. Interesting. You ever tested the Lord? Probably not knowingly. How often do we test the Lord? Thank you. Every day. Isn't that true? Paul says it pretty accurately. He says, you know, all of us have come short. Glory to God. That's every day. Why? Because we are of a sinful nature. And it is our inclination as sinful people to always be doing our own thing, to be self-willed. So, don't be too hard on the children of Israel. Yes, they had visual affirmation, experience with God. They had an audible one. They had the miraculous that went along with it. And some of you might even be saying right now, well, you know, we haven't had that in mind. I didn't have that in mind. God's never parted the sea for me. You know? He's never, you know, I live an extremely simple life, and you know, the Egyptians have never given me gold and silver. And we can easily get into that. That's called whining. Because God, the Yahweh God, the I Am God, one of those definitions of God is the God who is always present. Okay? He doesn't come and go. He's not flighty like we are often in our own relationships. He is always there. Have faith. He is always there. Even when you're dying of thirst, even when you think your enemies are going to crush you, even when life is difficult and hard and you don't know how you're going to make it through the Red Sea, God is there. He is present. That in itself is a wonderful blessing, isn't it? But you've got to believe it. Okay? It's not intellectual. It's spiritual. He says he will be there. And he promises he will be there. But we have to accept that, incorporate that into our hearts, into our relationships, and believe it. He says to us, took the children of Israel. Well, we're going to study more of it as we go through the book of Exodus. But it never really got figured out as a nation. As individuals, yes, but as a nation, they never figured it out. But it is interesting here. It says they tested the Lord, saying, and here it is, this is the big bomb. Is the Lord among us or not? That is the ultimate in a lack of faith. And yet, I don't know about you, but in my experience, because of my sinful nature, because of my self-willedness, when something bad happens, when there's a tragedy in my life, the first direction my head, my brain wants to go is God really here? That's so natural. Just like the needle to the pole, the first thing we think of is he really here? And we'll even say that to people. Lots of times I don't know if God's really in my life right now. Who says who? Says you? Says God? Not. God says, I will never leave you or forsake you. I am the I Am. I am always there. I am Yahweh. I will be your deliverer. I will be the one who blesses you. I will be the one who will never forsake you. I am your salvation. That is, by the way, one of the definitions of God. I am your salvation. I will never leave you. Wow. Is the Lord among us or not? Is the Lord in your life or not? He's given us ample evidence. He did better than part the sea. John 3:16 says he sent his son to die for us. To die for us. To die in our place. To die the final death so that we would not have to die that death. That's better than part of the sea, don't you think? What a beautiful story of a God who desires to have this intimate relationship with his people, who constantly is moving closer to that person. So there's nothing worse, and we probably all experienced it at some point in our life, but there's nothing worse than trying to get close to a person, whether it's emotionally or in love relationship or whatever, and that person scoots away, whether it's physically or emotionally. Every time you scoot over, they scoot away. Scoot over, scoot away. Don't you get the point? But God is constantly trying to move into our space. He is constantly trying to put his arms of love around us. He is constantly whispering in our ears sweet things, blessings, love. I love you. I keep scooting away. Scooting away. How long? How long will we scoot away from God? Next time you think or say to yourself, is God really with me? Remember the story of Israel. They're only a few months out from Egypt and they're already wondering, is God really with us? Excuse me? Who parted the sea? Who fed you this morning? Who provided protection from your enemies? So next time you ask that question, is God really here? Is he really in my life? Just remember that God defines himself as the one who is always present. There's nothing you can do about that. You can doubt it if you want. You can challenge it like the children of Israel did. But that's not going to change the fact and the reality. And the fact is that God is ever present in our lives. Not only is he ever present in our lives, but he is constantly experiencing life with us. He defines himself as God with us.
He's always there.
It's hard, I know. Because as humans, we're so used to relationships that are like a revolving door. And it's even gotten easier now, and we get more rejection now than we probably ever got. Because if somebody doesn't like you, or they don't like to sit on Facebook, they just take you off of their friends. That's it, you're gone. You're out of their lives. Please do not judge the awesomeness and the character of God that is an ever-present God. Do not judge God by the same guidelines that we judge one another or relationships we have here on this earth. Because God is so faithful. He is so awesome and so majestic and so glorious and so beautiful. And He wants to be so close to us. He wants to reach out. He wants to put His arms around us regardless of what we're going through. He knows you better than anyone else. And He's faithful and loving and caring and merciful. Wow. Never doubt God's relationship.